You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin food share benefits and requirements have seen some changes since the start of the COVID pandemic that's left some people confused. The director of Wisconsin Medicaid is here with us to give us an update on how the program has changed in the last few years, months, I should say, who's eligible, what benefits they can expect, and how to get started. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you using food share now or have you in the past? How did it help you? What was the application experience like? And do you have questions about how it all works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jamie Kuhn is the director of Medicaid at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, where she oversees the food share program. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Want to clarify some terms here. Now, people might hear at the federal level about SNAP, the food assistance program, but here in Wisconsin, we're talking about food share. Same thing?
Exactly. Yep. Food share is what Wisconsin calls the federal program.
And we sometimes use the phrase food stamps colloquially. We don't technically have the stamps anymore, but is food share the program that replaced that in effect?
Yes. Yep, exactly. We have Quest cards now, so there are no longer food stamps.
Okay. Now, things changed some over the COVID pandemic when it comes to a lot of public service or benefit programs. Congress loosened up some of the guidelines. What changed early in COVID and what has changed back with the end of the declared emergency?
Yeah, during the public health emergency, the federal government and the state government worked collaboratively to increase allotments for food share. So we had what we called emergency allotments, which allowed individuals to receive those who were not at their maximum, allowed them to receive additional food share dollars. And so since the public health emergency has ended, the emergency allotments have gone away. And so individuals have gone back to the amount and the eligibility levels that they were at previously, which really means that some families certainly got a bump during the public health emergency, and those additional funds did go away since the emergency allotments ended.
That was the allotments. Did eligibility change at all over the course of all that?
No, eligibility didn't change. So we are essentially back to routine operations now. So eligibility is still the same. It's just that individuals were able to receive more per month in certain circumstances. So individuals are still that are eligible for our program. It is still at the 200%. People are eligible for food share if their gross income is less than 200% of the federal poverty level. And so that continues moving forward. For people, that means to put it in dollar terms, for individuals that make less than $2,400 a month for a family of one, or $5,000 a month for a family of four.
And for someone who's hearing this and saying, hey, wait, I'm in that income level, I'm not currently receiving a food share, what is the process? What do they do to apply?
Yeah, so anyone can go online to access.gov and check their whether or not they are eligible for this and other programs that fall under Medicaid. You can also go into across the state. We have various what are called income maintenance offices, and you can work with folks there to see whether or not you're eligible and apply. And you can also call in, although as we all know, there is a lot going on with Medicaid redetermination. And so if you are able to go online, you can do a lot of this work online without having to call in to the centers. But you can also call in to our income maintenance centers and talk to an individual.
Do we know if we are using our food share to capacity? Is everyone who's eligible actually receiving it? Or is there a sense that there are a lot of people out there who could benefit from it, who would be eligible, but who, for whatever reason, haven't applied?
We have looked into this, and it does appear that there are groups of individuals who may be eligible that are not signed up for the program. So we do highly encourage individuals. What we're seeing anecdotally is that some individuals who are over the age of 54 that are eligible may not understand that they also can receive food share, and we encourage them to look into it and see if they are eligible. And I think we also are consistently seeing that children who are eligible are maybe not enrolled in the program.
Talking to Jamie Kuhn, Director of Medicaid at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, where she oversees the Food Share program. We're talking about Food Share, that's SNAP at the federal level, how it works in Wisconsin, who is eligible. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience to share using Food Share yourself, or maybe you've helped and advised people who do with maybe a hunger relief service in your neck of the woods, love to hear from you with your questions or your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jamie, a lot of political back and forth over work requirements for food assistance, in this case, food share. What is the current state of work requirements here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the federal government did change or update that through recent legislation. And so starting October 1, individuals between the ages of 18 and I believe, sorry, let me double check, 54 will be required to work. And so we work with individuals as they go through that process. To ensure that they have access to the supports that they need to adhere to those requirements.
And then there are various exemptions for people, even in that age range. So at the younger end of it, I think if you're still in school, what other kind of things that might allow people to opt out of those requirements?
So veterans, for example, and obviously individuals who may have received, whether it be a healthcare professional or otherwise, documentation, that they are not able to work.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Barbara is with us in Grand Marsh. Barbara, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to
I
tell us
called
about
because,
Barbara? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I'm just a little bit over what I would get a month in Social Security. I also have hospital bills. I'm 84 years old. I get $16 a month. There are nights when I just have popcorn. $16 a month doesn't cut it. If somebody comes in from another country, they are given more money than I get.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Now, can you talk a little bit, Jamie, about how much money people might get in different situations when they receive food share? It's not going to be the same for everybody.
Right, your household size as well as your income really determines how much you may be able to be eligible for. There are maximum allotment amounts, and again, that is affected by whether or not the number of people in your household and your income limit. But thank you for that. Thank you for calling in, and we too struggle with how to make sure that we are getting the that we are making sure that people have access to as much as they possibly can. And if you do have any questions about your allotment, you can always work with our IM agencies to review that.
And I wanted to ask that as a follow-up for Barbara, Jamie, if somebody says, you know, I think I probably should be eligible for more, and they want to check and make sure they're not getting a lower amount of food share than they might be eligible for, or if they're rejected for eligibility, are there systems in place for them to challenge that or to request a reevaluation?
Yeah, absolutely. We have what are called hearing processes so that people can appeal the decisions of our program, and then they have a process by which they can go through to contest that.
Barbara, thanks again for sharing your experience. We're talking to Jamie Kuhn, Director of Medicaid at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, about updates to food share since the pandemic started, what's changed recently, and in general, what to know about the program, what you need to know if you're thinking of applying for it. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Are you struggling to pay for groceries? Do you use food share now, or have you in the past? Have you run into obstacles in trying to apply for food share? Join in with your questions, your experiences, maybe your advice for other people in the process at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Jamie Kuhn, Director of Medicaid at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We're talking about food share here in Wisconsin. What's new? What eligible Wisconsinites should know? Still time for you to join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. If you use or have used food share at some point in your life, love to hear from you about the process, what it meant for you. Join in at 800-642-1234. Jamie, before we go back to our callers, can you talk a little bit about what people can and can't use their food share, their Quest cards to buy?
Yeah, certainly. So obviously, it is really focused on food. The program is really geared around trying to reduce hunger and ensure that we are supporting healthy outcomes. So the focus really is on making sure that you are spending it on actual food, not pet supplies, not any live animals, whether it be pets, fish pets, or otherwise, vitamins, medicines, supplements, and then of course any alcohol is also not allowed.
And do you coordinate the food share program with hunger relief programs in different parts of the state?
Yeah, absolutely. We're so grateful for all of our partners in this space. We are always working with different entities, but we acknowledge all of the community-based organizations, whether it's food banks or food pantries around the states, that not only do they help raise awareness about the program, but they also are on the ground helping individuals with enrollment in food share and doing so much as they did during the pandemic and even more now to ensure that hungry families have access to food. So they're a huge part of making this program successful.
Let's go back to our callers. Suzanne is with us in Milwaukee. Suzanne, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm in Milwaukee County, and I know that there is a program that functions called senior dining. And once a day, in different locations, one can get a wonderful meal.
Suzanne, we don't have a very good connection, but I think I made it out. There's a senior dining program, Suzanne says, in Milwaukee that could help out people like Barbara, our previous caller. And that actually fits right into what we were just talking about, Jamie, local providers. I mean, if somebody is applying for food share, is your agency able to help connect people with those things, or do they have to kind of go out and find them on their own?
No, I would say that the local organizations, as well as our income maintenance consortium and workers, certainly have work with partners and know where resources are. But obviously, at the local level, you have a lot of 211 access. You can call there to find out where other services are provided and where community food sources are, as well as sort of your local United Way and other organizations on the ground. They all do a great job of connecting with one another.
Thanks a lot for that call and that suggestion at 800-642-1234. Lance joins us now in Ashland. Lance, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I brought up, I'm originally from Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, and I moved up here many years ago because I love it in Wisconsin. But I know a lot of people that actually get food stamps and they trade them out from cash, you know, and they trade them out 50 cents on the dollar. And I was just wondering if there's any way they could tighten that up or there'd be some more security that they could stop that, because it's especially with low income people, they just they take the food stamps and trade them out for 50 cents on a dollar. And I was just wondering if there's any way they could stop that or if there's any way they could secure that so that couldn't happen.
Lance, thanks for the call. We don't have, as we talked about earlier, Jamie, the stamps anymore. Is there a system in place that guarantees that, you know, people use their Quest cards and, I don't know, can't sell them on the market?
Yeah, definitely. It is fraud, food share fraud, and we have processes in place that help one unearth these. But if individuals find that something, if individuals have had that happen to them directly, where someone has stolen their card, there are ways for them to report that through and make sure that they get a new card. But certainly we have a lot of measures in place. There are cases happening, and we certainly have our Office of Inspector General that investigates and deals with any fraud.
Lance,
but
thanks.
What I would say is that a majority of individuals are utilizing FoodShare to the way that that it is intended to be used for.
Thanks for the question, Lance. Ellen joins us now in La Crosse. Ellen, hello.
Hi, I'm calling in. I'm a benefit specialist in my area, and I help people understand how earned income might affect the benefits they receive, like Social Security, Medicaid, and FoodShare. I definitely don't pretend to understand the whole FoodShare calculation. I understand it's kind of complicated with credits being applied, certain utility allowances, but I just wanted to hear a little bit more about medical expenses and how folks can report those, and it can maybe help a FoodShare payment be higher.
And Ellen, before we let you go, what is there a particular community you work with when you work with FoodShare and Medicaid?
Yeah, people that are working through the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, so individuals with disabilities that are going to work, I counsel them on their benefits.
Ellen, thanks a lot for the call. Jamie, when people are filling out forms, is there a consideration of, oh, you have a lot of medical bills? Well, that comes out of your income as we calculate what you get in FoodShare benefit.
Yeah, and certainly thanks to the caller for doing that work, because it is there are a lot of rules and regulations, and we appreciate anyone who is willing to be on the front lines for that. Certainly there are exemptions for income that can be can help increase, to her point exactly, can help increase the allotment that you are able to receive. So there are very varying degrees by which that can be applied to the FoodShare program.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ellen. On the amount of the allotment, we heard from Chris in Milwaukee, who wonders, what is the maximum amount, say, for a family of four?
I was just looking at that, Rob. For a family of four, the maximum allotment is $973.
All right. Let's go back to our calls now. Raleigh is with us in Oak Creek. Raleigh, hi.
Hi. I'm not sure if this was brought up already, but with FoodShare, you can buy certain plants at a garden center that produce food, you know, i.e. tomatoes, peppers, pumpkin, even apple trees. But, you know, I'm thinking of the company Bonnie Plants, especially, that you find at many garden centers. But, of course, you'd want to check with the retailer, you know, before you try using the FoodShare. So just thought I'd enter that into the conversation.
Right. Thanks for the call, Raleigh. Interesting. So, Jamie, if a particular sales place does it, FoodShare can be used for food-producing plants?
So I think one of the things he's talking about is obviously healthy and fresh foods. So we obviously work with our local grocers and others, including many local farmers markets. And you can use your Quest card at any of those participating entities. I think another thing that is really great about trying to get fresh food with your Quest card is there are several entities right now that allow you to order online as well as get it delivered for those with mobility issues. And so that's another way to get fresher foods right but while utilizing your FoodShare benefits.
Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Mia is with us in Sheboygan. Mia, hi.
Hi, I'm in Sheboygan. I'm actually at the health department dropping off paperwork that is required for the FoodShare. It is child support paperwork. I just want to say that I don't want people to demonize people that are on food stamps. You know, I heard about some immigrants and people selling them off. Maybe people are lazy. I just want to say that, like, the majority of people really need this, and we are grateful. Also, I want to ask about the work requirement on October 1st. If a person has a child and they don't have a job, will they still receive the benefits? Because, you know, the child might go hungry. That's just my question.
Mia, thanks for the call. Jamie, do you have an answer for her?
So first off, I want to say thank you again for raising that issue. I think it is really important that we understand that any of us at any time could be in a situation, a food insecurity situation. And it is really important that we make sure that people understand this is a program through the federal government that is available for those who are eligible. I would have to look into that, but generally speaking, individuals are eligible in a household, and they collectively become eligible. But children are also children also have access to that as long as somebody is able to fill out the forms and apply for them. So if there is a situation that seems like it is they need extra supports, I would say back to one of our previous callers who is working in our income maintenance organizations. They really do understand how to help families, and in that way make sure that they are applying for the benefits they're eligible for.
We'll leave it there. Jamie, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Jamie Kuhn, Director of Medicaid at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, where she oversees the Food Share program. She talked to us about the latest on Wisconsin Food Share and what you need to know if you think you might benefit from assistance. Tomorrow on Central Time, electric cars and human rights abuses around the world. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Seems like everything can be smart nowadays in the world of technology, from phones to common household items like refrigerators and doorbells. While high-tech gadgets and apps can make our lives easier, the companies that make them are also in the business of collecting, even selling, our personal data. It's easy to see how something like a smartphone or fitness tracker could capture our data. Sometimes we're knowingly giving these devices our personal info. But a recent report from Mozilla's Privacy Not Included project found that the worst culprit when it comes to our data privacy could be our cars. Looking at the privacy policies of automakers, like all of them, the report finds data collected, used, even sold, including things like location tracking, the music we listen to, and even your sex life. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of companies collecting personal data through the products they sell and that we buy and use? Is it a trade-off you're willing to make in exchange for the convenience of smart devices? Do you have questions about cars, the computer technology, the apps that go along with them, and the info that they do collect and what they do with it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jen Kaltrider is a privacy researcher and founder of the Privacy Not Included Project at the Mozilla Foundation. Jen, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Now, you've looked at a lot of different product lines in Privacy Not Included. Cars apparently stand out as across the board the worst when it comes to our data. Why?
Oh, yeah. Cars were bad. You know, we've been reviewing fitness trackers and smart speakers and robot vacuums, and you see some bad things. But then you look at cars and you consider the fact that modern cars, cars built in the last 3 to 5 years, have sensors that can tell how much you weigh or where you're going and how fast. They have microphones. They have cameras facing in. They have cameras facing out. They have connected services that you know, let you listen to the radio or the tell you where to go. They have apps that help you start the car remotely. And all these things are collecting and sharing data back to the car companies, which, be honest, aren't the most ethical when it comes to privacy based on what we can tell in their privacy policies.
We'll dig into those privacy policies in just a moment. I want to talk about the Privacy Not Included project a little bit. Cars and, as you mentioned, lots of other products. What made you want to dig deep into the privacy policies behind the products we use?
Well, nobody likes to read privacy policies. So, you know, one day I woke up and said, I'll do it for you. And so back in 2017, more and more of our devices were getting connected to the internet, and there were review sites out there for, you know, features and reliability, Consumer Reports and CNET and places like that, but nobody was looking specifically at privacy. And Mozilla's mission in the world is to make the internet better. So we decided, let's do a buyer's guide for privacy and security of our connected products. And we started with the smart speakers and fitness trackers. And over the years, we've done any number of things, mental health apps, reproductive health apps, video call apps, robot vacuums, smart watches for kids. So, you know, you can go to privacynotincluded.org and read a review and know if what you're buying is good or bad, or if there's a better option.
Now, digging into the privacy policy of cars, it seems some models are bad, and they range from bad to terrible. What were some of the things that stood out to you as you started to go through these privacy policies when it came to the data that automakers can collect and what they do with it?
Yeah, cars can collect a huge amount of data. And, you know, we thought of cars as a private space, you know, a place where you can have a conversation with your kid or cry after a breakup or sing at the top of your lungs. But nowadays, cars have a lot of, you know, like I said, sensors. You know, we've got a camera on a lot of our faces to see if we're looking like we're sleepy. And those cameras can see us at all times, and cameras facing out. And then all the sensors these cars have, you know, the privacy policies say they can collect a ton of data on not just where we are, but how long a trip we're taking and where we're going and where we're stopping along the way and what internet radio station we're listening to and how many people might be in the car, whether you're using your seatbelt. And then, you know, you plug in those connected services and they're like, you know, hey, where did you go? Where did you stop? Outside of what store did you stop? And it's just a lot of data. And then there were some things that really surprised us in the privacy policies. When you're reading a privacy policy and you see that a company says they can collect your sexual activity and use it to facilitate direct marketing, you're like, wait a minute, like that raises an eyebrow. Why does a car need that to provide me the service of getting from point A to point B safely, or genetic information? And so, yeah, cars, I think car companies were kind of counting on us being, you know, not paying attention, but it's time to pay attention.
Talking to Jen Kaltrider from the Privacy Not Included Project at the Mozilla Foundation, looking at cars, described in their research as the worst product category we have ever reviewed for privacy. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about this, your worries. 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Will is with us in Oconomowoc. Will, hi.
Hey there. Well, I, after like 16 years of having my original car, which was a Chevy Trailblazer, and it, I don't think it had anything other than you know, just the starter battery. I got a 2020 Subaru Ascent, and as your caller's mentioning, yeah, it definitely does watch my face. It's got that eyesight feature. And as a teacher, our school district got hacked, so all my biometrics were taken. I got told that I had the ability, if I wanted, to join in a class action lawsuit, but really there was no like recourse for me to, and you know, my fingerprints out there. And at the end of the day, companies bartering and doing what they want with this information is one thing, but it seems like increasingly this stuff is up for grabs for hackers. And if the companies don't want the consumer themselves to know about it, then the companies probably really don't want us to know about how secure their silos are for this data, whether or not it gets hacked by bad actors or other companies.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. Jen, that is something you're worried about. Car companies have all this data that they say they can collect on us. What do we know about how secure that data is in their hands?
Well, interestingly, the majority, I believe the majority of the companies we reviewed actually did have serious security breaches or leaks in the past 3 years. That's something we looked at, is the known track record of companies. And Toyota and on down the line have had, you know, millions of personal, people's personal information leaked, security vulnerabilities in the cars that could let people access it, things like that. And so that's not uncommon. And on top of that, when you read a privacy policy, you'll often stumble across the section that will say something to the effect of, hey, we can't guarantee anything is going to be 100% sure that you share with us over the internet. So just know that we can't guarantee that your data is going to be safe with us once you share it. So they tell you that in their privacy policies.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Sorry about that hack at your workplace. We'll go now to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. When I use software, whether I buy it or whether it's free, I end up seeing now and then when I use it or when I log in, I need to agree to the privacy policy and the terms and conditions. So if I buy a car or some other product, that a physical product, am I going to end up agreeing to new versions of their policies and terms and conditions just to keep using the products?
Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. Jen, that's something you looked at, consent when we purchase the car and as we use it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, most people don't ever, you know, who bought a car don't be like, well, when did I consent to this privacy and data collection? You know, we saw one car maker said that just something as simple as becoming a passenger in a connected car, they considered you a user, which meant you had consented to their privacy policy. So a lot of times the consent that they're saying that they're getting from users is really not explicitly given. And then one of my favorite parts of reading these privacy policies was the lines that we saw in it where they said, it's up to you, the driver of the car, to let any passenger that gets in the car with you to know our privacy policies about data collection, which makes us chuckle because nobody picks up their buddy to go to a movie and says, wait, before we leave, I got to read you the privacy policy first.
Maybe you do.
Well, I'm not that bad. I'm close, though.
talking to Jen Kaltrider. Thanks a lot for that call. Jen is a privacy researcher and founder of the Privacy Not Included Project at the Mozilla Foundation. And we're talking about a new report that Jen co-authored, finding that cars are the worst offenders when it comes to data privacy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you drive a smart car? Would knowing that a car company is collecting your personal data make you think twice about purchasing from them? How do you feel about cars using artificial intelligence? Do you think the extra bells and whistles are worth the privacy trade-offs? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about cars and data privacy with Jen Kaltrider, privacy researcher and founder of the Privacy Not Included Project at the Mozilla Foundation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about companies sharing and selling your data? How about cars? Are you surprised to hear how much data car companies can collect from you while you use their product, whether you're driving or just catching a ride with someone else? Do you want to see regulations to change things? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hey, I am wondering how many of these data collection mechanisms could be disabled by the end user.
Interesting question, John. Can we opt out with our own cars, John?
Well, it's really hard to opt out. You know, I'll give you an example. Tesla, a very connected car, has in their privacy policy, they say, hey, you buy our car because it's connected. But if you want to opt out for data privacy reasons, sure, go ahead. Here's how. But they go on to say in that same paragraph in their privacy policy, oh, by the way, if you opt out, your car might become inoperable or not receive safety updates and become unsafe. And that's pretty common with these cars. They seem to link some of the safety features to the data sharing in ways that makes it hard for users to opt out and then still retain a safe, operable car in the ways that you want it to.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Robert joins us now in Abrams. Robert, hi.
Hey there. I just wanted to make a quick observation. It feels as though we've enabled a society with these legal agreements where we've created a disproportionate power aggregating to those who actually have all of this data. It's almost like a relationship of the one-way mirror where they have knowledge and insight into us, but we don't even know who they are. I think it's a pretty dystopian view of something as simple as transporting ourselves and our families to and from our places of business, school. It's a really bad distortion for society, in my opinion.
Robert, thanks a lot for the call. Jen, you've spent a lot of time researching and thinking about this. Do you feel that almost dystopian feeling about this data collection that Robert has?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. And I've been doing this since 2017, so I've just seen it get worse and worse year after year. And every year I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is horrible. And then the next year it gets worse. And one of the problems is that the United States doesn't have a federal privacy law. You know, the European Union has GDPR, which protects them, gives users the right for things like to access and delete their data, which we don't have across the board here in the United States. So I think it's past time for us to have a federal privacy law. I think, you know, car companies aren't going to change on their own. And so, you know, people should be getting mad and contacting their elected officials and saying, hey, let's fix this, because it is getting more and more dystopian.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Jen, with a lot of products, we might say, well, company A, I don't like what they're doing here. I'll go buy from company B. There is no company B, according to your report. They're all pretty bad, right? There's no, like, hero of the story here.
Yeah, there is no hero. All 25 of the car brands we reviewed earned our privacy not included warning label, which is a first. You know, we have standards, but we don't think our standards are so strict that companies shouldn't be able to meet them. And so, yeah, they're all bad. And it's hard when you want to tell people, here's some things that we think you can do to actually legitimately protect your privacy with cars. All I can really tell people is to get mad and call your elected official, which doesn't feel like much. But with every movement, there's a tipping point where people finally say enough. You know, maybe this will be the time when people say, this is enough. Let's fix this. This is not right.
What have you been hearing from people since this report came out? I know you've been talking about it in the media. Are you getting a sense that people are getting mad as heck, not willing to take it anymore, and reaching out to call for some kind of changes here?
Yeah, you know, I've been really pleasantly surprised by the response that we've gotten to this research as we were doing it. The three of us, the three researchers that I work with, we were all like, holy cow, this is so bad. I can't believe how bad it is. And how come nobody's talking about it? And we're like, oh, it's our responsibility to get people talking about it. And this is step one. You know, I get asked questions a lot about, well, how are they collecting it? And things that I can't answer because, you know, we couldn't dig into the technical side. So there's so much more to look into. And I've talked to people that are like, hey, I'm an engineer. I'm going to look into this more deeply. You know, I've had media outlets contact and be like, we're going to do a deeper dive on this. And so that's exactly what we're hoping to see, that this is step one. And people are starting to not just be aware, but to care. And again, you know, car companies don't have a long history of ethical behavior. You know, I'm old enough to remember the Ford Pinto. And so, you know, this is, you know, it took a lot of time to make changes on things like, you know, seatbelts in cars. And so it might take some time on this, but, you know, the ball is rolling, and I'm really happy to see you all paying attention and talking about it.
Jen, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thanks so much for having me.
Been talking to Jen Kaltrider, privacy researcher and founder of the Privacy Not Included Project at the Mozilla Foundation. We've been talking about her recent report showing that cars are the worst product category for privacy and what consumers can do to protect their personal data in a sea of smart products. You can check out that report. We're going to get a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. If you have concerns, if you've encountered things like this yourself, if you work in the automotive industry, love to hear your perspective. Still time. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org.